You're listening to the Jason Greger Show podcast, brought to you by Lakewood Chev. You want a truck? You want a great deal? You want great service? No better place to get it than Lakewood Chev. Shogger, do you have gout?
Well, that's a very personal medical question. That's
welcome back, Greger.
Private medical information that I might not be willing to share with the whole city.
You were whining about your toe injury on the morning show, so I listened to it. I was like, yeah, he's got gout, which is, I'm assuming, gout. What you have.
That's a rich man's.
You know, I learned a lot about this stuff today, and you know, gout. I think we need to end the stigma on gout. Gout is not a disease or a condition that is primarily for people who overindulge in alcohol and food and I think we need to end the stigma. Gout, as I was explained to me today, can be for very well-conditioned athletic people as well, who just have it that it runs in their family. So, I mean, I may or may not have it, but I just think it's important that we end the stigma of what gout is.
So do we have to go one of the insiders to find out if you have it? Like, do I have to text Darren Drager and find out if you have gout or what? Like, just be a voice. Be a leader.
I want Darren Drager to have no part in any of this. So if we can just leave him out of this entire process, I would be appreciative. We'll just keep this Edmonton's little secret, I'm sure.
Well, don't worry. We'll just keep it in Edmonton for sure. That was a really good quote, though. I'd like to use that. We have to end the stigma with gout. It isn't just for people who overindulge in alcohol or food.
It's for athletic people as well.
Yeah. It's for athletic people as well. Good one. Andre Sekera has been sent down on a conditioning assignment, but because he's off LTIR, there's like a window of 6 days or a maximum 3 games that he can play, and then they would have to activate him on the roster. He goes down now. They're going to have to change up a winning lineup, man. These guys are undefeated. They've won 10 in a row down in Bakersfield, and Sekera, at least he'll be coming in on a winning time, so that'll be good for him. That'll probably be a change of pace.
Yeah, well, this is important for the organization to figure out where this player's at, because he's a big bite of their cap. And, you know, when he plays well, he's a usable defenseman. But what he's got left after these back-to-back injuries, I'm not sure. So I did some reading while I was at the airport the other day, and there's a clause in the CBA that basically says that they can ask the commissioner for permission to extend a conditioning assignment an extra 2 days. So it would normally be a 3-game stretch. They can, with the commissioner's permission, they can extend it to 5 games. And then if it goes well, and they decide to, you know, to activate him off of that, then he goes on the roster. And obviously then decisions need to be made and they'll have to do some maneuvering. But it could be up to 5 games that they have to, if the commissioner gives them the green light.
Yeah. And I'm fully expecting that they're going to go and ask for those 5 games just to buy time to see where he's at. Because, you know, if he comes up here, and there's all the cap situation, but there's a lot of D-men up here they'd have to find either a new home for or a place to go.
Well, there's the thing I was going to talk to you guys about. Because in order to activate Sekera, they have to shed over, it's $1.23 million, right? In actual salary cap hit. So if you waived Manning or Petrovic, that only clears 1.025. You'd have to make another move unless they waive Petrovic first, because I think there's a chance someone would claim him, guys. No one's claiming Manning because he has another year at 2.25, whereas Petrovic would basically be like a rental that you get at the trade deadline, right? And he's a right shot defenseman, which teams are always looking for, and he's a UFA at the end of the season. Now, it won't look good because you'll have given up a third round pick for 6 games of him, but I think that's a very realistic option right now. I think the Oilers might do that. That might be their only thing. Otherwise, they have to make 2 moves.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, could they not just go a guy shorthanded on the roster as well, to keep the space cleared up?
Like, yeah, but they got to make 2 moves then, is what I'm saying, right? They'd have to send 2 guys down, one of those 2 defensemen and someone else.
Right, so one of those defensemen, and then a forward like Malone or somebody like that, and then you go shorthanded while you're figuring things out, right? You go one below your roster limit, and you can save yourself some space.
You can go with 20. You can do that, but then you're going with 12 forwards, right? Is what? So you're going to say they're going to carry 8 defensemen and 12 forwards?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no question it gets a little bit complicated for them.
Either way, though, you're waiving one of those 2 defenders, And like, if you waive Petrovic and he got claimed, then you don't worry, because that's actually the whole full 1.9 comes off, and that clears it up for Sekera, right? Whereas you can waive Manning, but I don't think anyone's taking him when he's got another year left on his contract at $2.25 million. I think a team might take Petrovic, and as bad as it looks, I think they might make that move first. And I think they might make it. Let's say they realize it's three games for Sekera, right? Which I think is Saturday. So let's say they put Petrovic on waivers on Saturday just to see if no one claims him, they keep him up, and then they wait another day or two, and then when they want to activate Sekera, they send him and the other guy who has to clear waivers down at the same time, and away they go. I could see that. But I think you might see a move on Saturday or Sunday where Petrovic is put on waivers just to see, because they have to clear cap space.
Well, yeah, you'd be waving goodbye to a third rounder. Greg,
yeah, that's the thing. I think
it's not ideal.
The orders
trust me.
Are in a bind, and so they're not going to do the orders any favors. But I mean, you'd think maybe you could get the player playing here, and maybe try and if you need to make a trade or try and figure out another way other than to just lose a guy that you made that deal for absolutely nothing. Who still, I still think he's a serviceable third pairing defenseman. I wouldn't just be, I think that I could see them looking for ways around it beyond having to do that. But I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, well, they could try to work a trade, but every team knows that, like, maybe a team who wants him will secure a trade for a late round pick just so they get him, because they don't think they'd be one of the first teams to get him on the waiver wire, right? That's the only other option.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, they got to get Klefbom back and playing and get a few games under his belt and get him going, you know, where they know he's healthy and they know he can stay and that he's going to be okay. You know, I think that it's this funny injury where, you know, I think he tried to play, you know, tried to practice with it a little bit, and it gave him some trouble, and now all of a sudden he needs a few more days, and so I think he'll take another run at it tomorrow with the hopes that it'll be okay, but I think it's finicky. And so I don't know that they want to be too aggressive in making permanent moves when they just need to get Klefbom back and playing and have some confidence that he's going to be able to sustain it and keep going for a little bit before they start pitching usable defensemen out the door.
Talking with Ryan Rashog from NHL and TSN. Shogger, the Oilers penalty kill this weekend. I believe it was 5 goals in 2 games that given up. Not ideal. What did you see that was of concern and needs to be addressed? Because that puts way too much pressure on your 5-on-5 and power play.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to make the most of your opportunities to clear first and foremost, and you have to win faceoffs. If you don't win faceoffs and if you miss opportunities to clear, you're killing yourself twice in the same shift. You have to get the puck out when you get a chance. Number of players, Nugent Hopkins included, had opportunities to clear and didn't, and it ended up in goals. So I would say those two things are pretty critical. The other one, I think, though, I didn't quite understand why, again, it's kind of this hinge penalty kill they use where when the puck shoots up to the point and then shoots across to the other point, they want the low defenseman to flare out, get into the shooting lane, and block that shot coming in from the point. That's Shea Weber. I mean, I don't think you can run that penalty kill when you've got Shea Weber teeing up a one-timer from that far point. I just, on the one he scored, if you watch Cassian, I mean, the forward's instructions are to not let that pass get through the middle. They're okay with it moving around the top, but you can't let it through the middle. So Cassian goes passive. He kind of tries to gum up the works in the middle, and the D-man, I think it was Russell, is supposed to flare out. He's still 25 feet away from Shea Weber, who's teeing up and uncorking a one-timer. So I didn't like that they were okay with Weber getting that cross-ice pass on the one-timer and expecting that D-man to handle it. I think you need to tailor your power play for the other team's weapons sometimes, and I just wouldn't have left him alone in a shooting gallery like that.
Yeah, I'm going to get into this. Actually, you've just stole my strides on. I'm going to get into this in the next segment. And it's a really interesting thing because Montreal doesn't have a great power play. I think they're around like 15% or something. But the way the Oilers set up their PK is pretty much perfect for what Montreal was trying to do. And I think I would have adjusted it to maybe a box to eliminate those two side guys or even just an umbrella, a 3-on-1 or something to change up, because it was way too. You could see those guys alone up, and Kotkaniemi on the other side. He's got a nice little one timer too.
Yeah, for sure. And it's tough because if you want to take away the points, then you get exposed through the middle, right? Because the way you clog up the middle is you take that other forward and you put them in the middle. And if their sticks are in the proper lanes, theoretically, you can make it so that they can't get through there. That's the idea. But when you got Shea Weber over there unable to just unleash that thing the way he does, and then you've got players playing passive on the pass across to him, and you expect that defenseman to get out to, I mean, expecting a defenseman to step into the shooting lane of Shea Weber's point shot from 30 feet away, first of all, you're either going to get scored on or someone's going to get hurt. I just think you can't expect guys to do that. I think that's, if I were one of those defensemen in the power play meeting, or in the penalty kill meeting, I'd be going, what? You're not, but why can't he just go there? I don't want to do that. Yeah, why can't he just go there? You know?
Ryan Rashog from TSN joins us. Now, we can talk scheme all we want, and I want to get Strud's thought on this as well, on the penalty kill. We can talk scheme all we want. This is 2 years now that the Oilers' penalty kill has hovered around 75%. And there's been two head coaches, there's been two different defensive coaches, and it's not changing. At some point, don't you look, Struddy, they don't have enough guys who are willing to commit to what it takes to be a decent penalty killer. Am I wrong on this?
Well, you're not, because the proof is in the penalty kill numbers. I mean, it's not hard to figure out. You know, I went back and watched them all, and they were kind of beaten all different ways. I mean, the first goal of the weekend was a backdoor tap-in. And I saw a lot of people saying, oh, a terrible goal let in by Talbot. I'm like, actually, no, because Talbot's committing to stop the shot. The D-man's supposed to take away the backdoor tap, and I believe it was Gravel on that one. And then the one you just mentioned was the one-timer from Shea Weber. Like, is Russell supposed to go out there and lay down in front of Shea Weber's shot? He took away half the net, and it beat Koskinen short side. So, you know, there's a lot of different things. It's Jogger, you nailed it. Getting the puck out when you get a chance, taking an extra second to get it out. There's a chance where a D-man just ringed it around the far side instead of turning up short side, hammering it out. It's getting in the shooting lanes, not getting too spread out, because that's what they're. Montreal actually ran it around pretty good. Get tape to tape, they're snapping around and they got spread out. And it's patience and knowing where to be. And I think that I got to believe at some point you got to look at the personnel. It's not working with the personnel they have.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I think that they had trouble last year getting guys to step into shooting lanes. It was an issue that they had. I know internally it was a frustration that they had. Getting guys to step into those shooting lanes, and often it was those defensemen having to step up on those other defensemen walking in from the blue line and unleashing. It's not a fun thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's tougher to do when you're 16 points out of a playoff spot or whatever the heck it was. Now, I'm not saying that's an issue with this year's group. But I think that personnel wise, it's got to be a point of pride. I think it's got to be a challenge. It's got to be viewed as, an opportunity and a privilege to be out there doing that. And it's got to be taken seriously. And if guys are consistently not doing well at it, they got to switch out other guys. And they got to put guys in there that take it seriously and want to make it part of building value into their game. And I think it's important to have guys out there that view it that way.
Shogger, before we let you go, just a few things. Number one, cherry juice supposedly is very good. And one of our 33-year-old listeners who has had gout, he's younger than you, says,
this is if I have gout, by the way.
Teva, indomethacin, and allopurinol. Okay, so check that out, and all the best in your alleged gout recovery.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's what it is. I think it's probably more a stress fracture from all of the athletic activity that I do all the time.
Yeah,
that's more obvious right now. But if it is gout, which is probably not, thank you for the great advice.
I'll
Dregs.
I'll just say one thing, Chargo. Is it really athletic endeavor when you're riding a recumbent bike? Like, how do you get hurt on that thing?
Like, did you sprain your toe trying to get off of the? What was that other machine? The elliptical? Well,
elliptical and recumbent. Like, that's elliptical. Not athletic endeavors.
Yeah.
The elliptical is, you get a good sweat on the elliptical, and it's repeated movements on your joint. It's an athletic endeavor, and it's to be taken seriously. I might have to take a break because the elliptical has been too strenuous for me.
Yeah. For you. If you're straining your toe on the elliptical where you're not supposed to lift your foot, I think you're doing it wrong.
I don't want to take advice from you guys. Like, you guys know. Struds, you only played in the NHL, and Gregor, you're posting shirtless pics all over Facebook. I don't know what's going on here.
Have a good one, Shogger, and best of luck in recovery.
See you guys.